Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. By the time Bing Crosby crooned Brother, Can You Spare a Dime in 1932, the country was fully embroiled in the Great Depression. The landscape of U.S. history is riddled with peaks and valleys of prosperity and depression. And what the economic topography of the past shows us is that the current fiscal cliff is definitely not the first. As is popular in moments of current crisis, many are now turning to the past for answers. Today, we'll consider the fiscal cliff scenario of the 1930s in comparison to the present. Coming up, we're going to speak with Jessica Wehrman, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau. But joining us right now is OSU history and law professor David Steben to talk about the fiscal scenario of the 1930s as it compares to the present situation in Washington. David, welcome back to the program.
A pleasure to be here.
We've heard over and over again about the comparison between the Great Recession and the Great Depression, but so much has changed since the 30s in terms of, you know, the input versus and the output, hasn't it? What are the big differences?
Well, for one thing, in the 1930s, there was no Social Security program yet operational. There was no Medicare program. There was no unemployment insurance program. So we made our way through the 30s without those kinds of safety net programs that today help prevent the Great Recession from being like the Great Depression. And so there's also a much more extreme economic contraction. And people ask me, well, how extreme was it? And nowadays, people tend to pay attention to the stock market. Between October of 1929 and July of 1933, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost exactly 90% of its value. And that's much more extreme than anything we went through over the last 5 or 6 years. That said, there are some parallels. In other words, the interesting thing for an historian, and I'm writing a book about America from the 30s through the 60s, is how you talk about an era that is in some ways similar and in other ways different. And I'm happy to do that today. And I would also argue, or at least explain, that none of this is meant to be in any way partisan or political. The parallel with the 30s has been drawn both by people in the Obama administration, such as Ben Bernanke, the current head of the Federal Reserve Board, but also by senior people who served in the Reagan and Bush administrations. And so, for example, there was an op-ed column written in the New York Times in July of 2011 by a man named Bruce Bartlett entitled, "Are We About to Repeat the Mistakes of 1937? And he's a distinguished figure who held senior policy roles in the Reagan and George Bush senior administrations and also worked for Congressman Jack Kemp and Congressman Ron Paul. So there are people who consider themselves conservatives as well as liberals who are making this comparison.
When you talk about the safety net programs, those are in their way stimulus programs. In other words, when we have high unemployment, so do we have high expenditures and unemployment benefits.
Correct. And so that whole mechanism had not yet come into being in the 30s, which is one of the reasons why the Great Depression is so much worse in terms of people's ability to spend money and drive the economy upward, and also why it's so much worse in terms of basic living conditions. The Social Security program is a gradual creation. In other words, as I'm sure you know, it is the result, your own Social Security check, if you're in the system, is the result of, in part, making payments over 30 years. The point is, the Social Security program as we know it today didn't mature until the mid-1960s, because that's when people began to have 30 years of contributions. And so it's like watching a snowball gradually roll downhill. But it took a long time for that snowball to get big. And so the Great Recession has been a very unpleasant experience for many people. And I don't mean to understate that. The Depression was far worse for the reasons I've mentioned. And the unemployment rate was also far worse. And the unemployment rate was so high in many places in the 1930s that the official statistics ceased to be an accurate number. Because in our system, most of the time, we have a high employment economy, not a full employment economy, but a high employment economy. And so we've devised a way of counting the unemployed to reflect that, which is people actively seeking work. And if it's a high employment economy most of the time, that's a pretty good measure.
We're looking at the smaller number, usually the unemployment.
Right. But in a period of prolonged high unemployment, the way we calculate unemployment becomes unreliable. Because if you have prolonged high unemployment, the rational thing to do is to stop looking, at least for a while, until prospects get better. The way I think of this, football metaphors are popular at OSU with the students. People more and more in the 1930s sit on the sidelines waiting for the economic game to improve before they look again. And so the official unemployment rate peaks at about 23-24% in the Great Depression, but that's too low. In other words, a more accurate number averaged across the 30s would be about a third, which is a much higher number than most people realize because it isn't the official statistic. And I don't criticize the news media of the 1930s. To have publicized the accurate economic information would have been even more depressing, discouraging to businesses wanting to hire and invest. So there's this dilemma, again, in a in a high employment economy, in a prosperous economy, business reporting is fairly straightforward. You don't have to worry that the articles that you run will in some way make the economic situation worse. In the Great Depression, there was a very real danger of that. And so much business reporting doesn't tell the whole story. Out of a responsible desire not to make things worse, they're already bad enough. And so it's very hard to see how bad the economy is in the 1930s. The way in Columbus, for example, you can tell from time to time how bad it is if Huntington Bank or one of the major department stores downtown announces that they have 20 jobs to fill. And then there's a line of people that stretches out the door and around the building in concentric circles of 1,000 or 2,000 people. But if you're the editor of the Columbus Dispatch, do you print that picture? It's a very interesting, arresting image. But if you print it in the 1930s, do you just make people even more worried? And so it's hard to see the effects of the Great Depression. And so it explains why people were so phobic about it for so many decades after it went away. Right? You can still find ordinary Ohioans who have no personal memory of the Great Depression, but their parents did, and it has affected their life behavior, the way they approach savings ever since. So the Great Recession, as bad as it is, mm-hmm. when people ask me what's the biggest difference, there is significant high unemployment, but the more normal experience of this has been sort of significant underemployment, whereas in the 30s, it's more just being out of work completely.
My guest is David Stubben. He teaches history and law at Ohio State University. He will talk about the fiscal crisis of the 1930s and its consequences tomorrow evening on the OSU campus. We have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to check that out and get more information. That's tomorrow at, I think, just about 5 p.m.
5 p.m., that's right. And go ahead.
Well, I wanted to invite people, if you have a question or comment for David Stubben, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there, or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. It's interesting how you're talking about how it was perceived versus the reality, because anybody who's studied anything about history perceives the Great Depression as something horrible.
Yes.
But it was even worse.
That's right. And
which should make us feel better, that much better about.
Well, I don't know if you're unemployed or underemployed.
But as an economy as a whole.
Correct. And it's a reminder that the economy, as a result of the Great Depression, acquired some safety features that it just didn't have in that earlier era. But I do think it's hard if you're not doing well to be very much comforted.
When economists look at what happened in 2008 and subsequently, do they take into account, because you often don't hear about the Social Security and unemployment compensation and food stamps and all of that kind of stuff, all these safety nets that we have now referred to as stimulus, but
They're not usually intended to be that. Right. In a high employment economy, say 95% of those who want work can find it. The economy's rolling along. They do stimulate some, but their primary purpose is insurance to help people who have disasters or if in old age they have accumulated savings. their counter-cyclical qualities, to use the economist term, really kick in bad economies. And we don't have that all the time, or most of the time. But when we do, one feature of the system is that.
When they're making arguments in Congress about raising, or they're debating in Congress or whatever about raising or continuing or extending unemployment benefits, does the issue of its stimulus effect in this bad economy come up?
It does. And it also prevents other sorts of problems. In other words, if people lose their income, other sorts of family breakup, it can be very hard on small children who are being supported indirectly by the parents, unemployment benefits. If you talk to the police departments, the last thing they want is for joblessness to grow a lot in communities that are already distressed, because it usually means more crime. The highest recorded rates of violent crime in the United States came during 1932-33, during the worst years of the Great Depression.
Because the food riots and that sort of thing?
That's right, but also bank robberies. Bank robbers are, to the great—
Bonnie and Clyde.
Right. It's both so disturbing to many leaders of American society. It's not just that they're out there and active. It's that they're folk heroes to a significant segment of the population. In other words, the values system is turned upside down by the Great Depression. So you literally have significant numbers of poor people who are rooting for the criminals in these bank robbery situations. Pretty Boy Floyd, among the most famous examples, in part because he would take some of the money that he stole and hand it out to poor people in the area to buy shoes and things like that. So there was a crisis in values. Also, rates of suicide and spousal abandonment were very high, because if the breadwinner, to use an old-fashioned term, couldn't find a job, the most common response was often, I'm going to go look out west or something for it, and they never were heard from again. But often there were small children involved. So there are all sorts of purposes served by these unemployment benefits. And people in Congress sort of know this. In other words, there's a built-up wisdom about what they do in hard times. So, but the point is, in the 30s, we don't have that. So when President Roosevelt comes in, the economy is terrible, really terrible. And a decision is made by his advisors and by people in Congress who are— and the people running Congress by that point are Democrats, because of the political effects of the Great Depression— to spend money, to run deficits, to pay for temporary unemployment benefits, to insure bank deposits, to create a system of price subsidies for farmers to help prop up farm income, which had fallen off a cliff from 29 to 33. But the problem is, almost everyone in Washington in those days what today we would call a fiscal conservative, someone who believes in a balanced budget for the federal government.
Democrats and Republicans alike.
Right. And the people running Congress are mostly Southern Democrats, because in those days the South was a one-party Democratic region, and most of them are strongly fiscally conservative. So the only way you can persuade fiscal conservatives to go along with what we would call deficit spending in the early years of the Roosevelt administration is to promise them that once we've begun a sustained recovery, the deficits will go away. And that's what brings us to 1937. In other words, once President Roosevelt is reelected by a landslide in 1936, the pressures in Congress on him to balance the budget become very strong. And the fact that the Democrats are in charge, that's really different from today, right? The two parties share power. But there are Democrats and there are Democrats. And the people in charge in Congress are, in some sense, the same people who are in charge in the House today. In other words, the Republican caucus today is dominated by Southern conservatives. And in the 30s, the Democrats in Congress were dominated by Southern conservatives. And when I say conservatives, I mean in almost all respects, including fiscal conservatives. So the idea is, well, you know, we've spent more than we've taken in for 4 years. The economy has steadily improved from 1933 to early 1937. Now is the time to balance the books. So between January and June of 1937, the federal government basically balances the books. In other words, it raises taxes, it lowers spending, and almost achieves an exactly balanced budget by June of 1937.
To its own peril, however.
Right. Well, and that's— – they didn't use the fiscal cliff term has only been popularized since February of 2012, when Ben Bernanke used it in a hearing that was televised and then it went viral. But that concept applied even more in June of 37, because as soon as the budget was balanced, the economy literally fell off a cliff.
We are going to return to our conversation comparing the fiscal cliff of 2013 to that of the 30s. When we return with David Stebbin, he's professor of history and law at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Celeste Headlee. Every day brings fresh developments and interesting stories to tell. At Talk of the Nation, we look for the stories that matter to you. From international news to the latest campaign politics to the issues that touch your family, tune in to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. It's 29 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect sunshine and a high of 35 today. There's a chance of a light rain-snow mix tonight, a low of 29. Support for 89.7 comes from Dr. Ron Linehan, MD of Precision Pain Care, with offices in Lancaster and Canal Winchester. Dr. Linehan treats acute and chronic pain of the back, neck, and other debilitating pain sources. Precision Pain Care. More at precisionpaincare.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is OSU history and law professor David Stebbin. He is speaking tomorrow to talk about the fiscal crisis of the 1930s and its consequences. He'll be on the OSU campus. If you're interested in checking out that lecture, you can go. Which is free and open to the public. You can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides and check out our link there. If you have a question for David Stebbin, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the fiscal cliff, it hit hard in 1937-38, right?
It did. And
which is when a lot of us thought things were getting better.
Right. Well, they had steadily improved and improved in a big way. From the summer of 33 to the spring of 37. And so if you're trying to be charitable about what Congress and the president did then, and by the way, Congress by the spring of 37 has 3/4 majorities of Democrats in both houses. So as a partisan matter, this is an all Democratic Party event, this fiscal cliff episode. Although keeping in mind the Democratic Party then is different from what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
So there had been this very strong improvement, and so one conclusion you could draw was, okay, a self-sustaining recovery has begun. So let's balance the budget. And why balance the budget? FDR was very close to his Treasury Secretary. They literally were neighbors in New York, Henry Morgenthau, before he became Treasury Secretary. And Treasury Secretaries talk to the business community and to bankers regularly. It's part of the job description, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. So what's Morgenthau hearing over the course of the first 4 years? You cannot keep running these deficits. You will ruin the economy. In other words, the conventional wisdom of the day is most of the time the federal budget must be balanced, like a household budget. And so Morgenthau talks to Roosevelt a lot in early 1937 and said, look, sustaining this recovery that's begun depends ultimately on the willingness of business to increase investments. And the business community is increasingly frightened by the substantial deficits that continue year after year. You don't really want to lose the confidence of the bankers and major industrialists. And so really now is the time to show that your long-term goal is to restore a sort of traditional approach to budgeting. Otherwise, business confidence will tank, they won't invest, they won't create new jobs, and the economy will collapse in it for a different reason. And so Roosevelt takes that advice. It's also widely shared by the conservative Southern Democrats who are running all the major committees on Capitol Hill. So that's the logic behind this. In other words,
which we hear today.
Well, absolutely. That's part of the reason that I decided that I should talk about this in this lecture. In other words, it's part of a book project I've been working on for a long time, but there are parallels. In other words, there's a time-honored debate. What matters more in making a modern economy strong, the consumption side, ordinary people buying things, or the investment side, the investor class investing money in existing plants and equipment and businesses to make them grow and so on? And obviously, I think most people would agree it's a combination of those two factors, some consumption, some investment. The really difficult question is that at any given moment in the economy, which matters more, right? And so Morgenthau is telling FDR in the spring of 1937, it's the investment side that's now key. You can't keep running these deficits. Business won't invest. They're spooked by the side of the deficit. And the fact that it just seems to, you know, the glide path is ever more because you're expanding the size of government, creating these programs that help stabilize farm prices, ensure bank deposits, help the unemployed. And so unless you do something, these deficits will grow and business confidence will collapse. So that's why Congress does what it does. And also, FDR, in some sense, is a little hemmed in because the way he got the Southerners in Congress to agree in the first place to deficit spend was to promise that once a boom began, a sustained recovery began, that he would balance the budget. So he's keeping his promise. So for all those reasons, he goes along with what the advice he's getting. And the Congress really does something quite dramatic in terms on the spending side. It reduces overall federal spending 17% in 37-38. That's a lot. And it increases tax collections. And the result, as I say, the deficit almost entirely disappears, but then the economy falls off the cliff. And what I mean by that is what's scary about it in 37-38 is not that it goes all the way back to where the low point had been in the summer of 33. What's scarier about the fiscal cliff episode in 37-38 is that the angle of descent is much sharper. In other words, 29 to 33 is a downward spiral. Cliff implies you fall almost straight down, and that's what the economy does in 37-38. The only reason it doesn't keep going down is after about 10 or 11 months of this, Roosevelt and Congress reverse course and approve increased spending. They ease up on the monetary policy side, and so the economy levels off. But that sort of sustained growth recovery is interrupted, and until World War II comes along, it doesn't really resume. So there's this awful period of the late 30s when the Great Depression returns, so to speak. But people have already spent all their money, they're tapped out. So the fact that it goes on.
There wasn't enough of a recovery before then to buoy people
That's right.
Beforehand. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with OSU Professor of History and Law, David Stebbin. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Austin in Lancaster, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Thank you guys very much, first of all.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I have one question, and I'll take my answers off the air. It's kind of complex, though, so I'll beg for your patience. I'm wondering if these fiscal cliffs that we run into maybe expose today more so than even in the 1930s, expose a side of a more natural tendency of human society and the federal government kind of falls in line with that when we go over these cliffs, because you spoke of how we increased social spending or increased government spending, period, for all those programs to rehabilitate kind of society as a whole through an economic means. But I'm wondering if right now, if we go over this fiscal cliff, if a lot of people will fall into a more primal sense of motivation and where food will become a worry, whereas nowadays people are having a hard time money-wise, yes, but I live in a place that doesn't make all that much money over the area, and a lot of people here seem pretty damn well-fed. The kids are what I worry about the most, and that's what I'm saying, is it seems like we're falling from a materialistic, superficial kind of predisposition back into a more naturalistic, kind of long-term goal, long-term-oriented society where we focus more on each other and more on the interconnectedness and dependency that we share with our environment.
It's David Stebbin?
A very good, thoughtful question. In other words, focusing on a recovery that enables people to buy more things at the mall that they really don't need, and don't have storage space for, doesn't seem so sensible. One of the differences between now and then is that today, a large majority of the population holds a mortgage on their home. In other words, this mass home ownership phenomenon doesn't really come along until the 1940s. There is a foreclosure crisis in the 1930s, but it mostly has to do with family farms. Today, one of the most troubling aspects of the Great Recession is how many homes are worth less than people paid for them, if not less than what's outstanding on the mortgage. And so if we are to have a fiscal cliff episode and the economy slumps again, one of the worst things that would likely happen is this business of more homes being underwater or being worth less. And that relates to sort of family life. In other words, it's people's homes. They're in school districts. They're in neighborhoods. To the anything that increases the extent to which people are uprooted and have to move and so on, it's hardest often on small children who are in school, who have an existing set of friends and so on. So it depends on what the income and so on and the prosperity is to be used for. If it's to pay for a not-too-big house in a good neighborhood where people want to stay and save up for college or old age or whatever, then you can see the very real social consequences. The question is very right. Food is cheaper now than it used to be, although even that is sort of an illusion. In other words, in the sense that we talk about food as though all food is alike. What's happened since the 1960s is that there's been an explosion in the amount of really high-end food, which most people can't afford, high-end in terms of quality, and really cheap food, full of salt, sugar, and fat that people can easily afford, but that is not good for them, especially not for children who are growing. And so when we talk about the price of food, the academic in me always asks, well, what kind of food are you talking about? If it's sort of nutritious food that's really good for families and children, the real cost of that is actually has gone up significantly in recent years. Gasoline is another issue because there is a kind of mass automobility in the 1930s by world standards, but the majority of American homes in the 1930s don't own a car, have a car, in part because a large percentage of people live in central cities and are served by mass transit. Mm-hmm. Today, if the price of gasoline goes up significantly during hard times, that has a much more profound impact on people's budgets. Because we're a predominantly suburban country, people have to drive on a daily basis. And so what I look at in terms of do people have enough money, can they buy good food for their families, and do they have enough to drive to work and back and everywhere else? And the food and gasoline part of people's budgets has gone up in cost over the past 4 or 5 years.
When I was preparing for this, I read about the backlash against recent immigrants and how many, I think particularly Mexicans, were deported. They weren't necessarily illegally here, but they were deported during the Depression. And we have an email from Amber who asks, what does the professor think would have happened if during the Depression, if the president had proposed adding millions of foreign nationals to the legal workforce?
Well, that idea would have been a complete non-starter because the unemployed workforce that was already here was enormous, right? I mean, if you could pick out foreign nationals who come with lots of skills and investment capital, those are the only people you're going to let in, then you might have been able to move a bill like that through Congress. But most immigrants historically who've come to the United States have very little money and don't necessarily have many skills, and they're here for opportunity. And in the long run, they contribute typically to American economic growth and success. They improve our cuisine, our culture.
Entrepreneurial class.
Right, all of that. Mm-hmm. But in the short run, they tend to add to the burdens, mostly on city government in terms of educational costs for the children, unemployment insurance, or just basic kinds of food relief or whatever. So there's an existing legal regime, a set of laws passed in the 1920s to keep most immigrants out. The likelihood that those laws can be revised during a Great Depression is really low. The only way they're ever going to get revised is during a more prosperous time.
Dave in Columbus, you're on the air with David Stebbin. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question. My family, my grandmother talked about at some point during the Great Depression, right toward the beginning, as I understand it, that her father, who was in business in a small town, sold affordable used cars to workers. he had a lot of cash that he needed to have in order to run this business, because when a cheap car came available, he had to buy it and he had to fix it. Story goes that he discovered that the banks were to be closed the evening that the evening preceding to the banks being nationalized, and went over at dinner time to a friend of his who ran the bank, and at some force, story goes with gunpoint, but the truth is he never owned a gun. He came in, said, "I put my money in, profanity, get it out." And he was the only one solvent in the community simply because he was the only one who showed up and was able to get the bank president to open the bank. You see the same thing in It's a Wonderful Life. Everybody's got their life savings and they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me more about that? I don't know much about it, but it seems to have been a huge deal, even in It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay.
Well, another very good question and a reminder of how the world is different now. In other words, there was no system of federal insurance of bank deposits when the Great Depression began. And a lot of bank investment officers had chosen to buy stock as the stock market soared in the mid and later 1920s. And then when the market collapsed, the value of those investments, at least temporarily, was very low. And so banks increasingly were insolvent. If depositors wanted their money out, then there wasn't really enough money in the bank to give them. And so by the time this problem gets worse and worse, and by the time FDR takes over on March 4th, 1933, the bulk of the banks of the country have closed their doors. In particular, in New York State and Illinois, home to New York City and Chicago, which had the biggest banks and the biggest potential deposits. So there's a desire to reorganize the system and agree and create a system that we have today of federal deposit insurance. A law had been written to do this in the waning months of the Hoover administration, but he was philosophically resistant to this because he understood, Hoover was a very intelligent man, that if we have a system of federal insurance, then we have to have a system of federal inspection. In other words, the government is going to have to know what bankers are doing all the time. Otherwise, to simply insure bank deposits would be to give a blank check to bankers to do irresponsible things because the government will always bail them out. And it was that expansion of government role into the private sector of banking that bothered President Hoover. So the law is drafted. It's ready to go, but it's not yet in force. It's not been passed because he won't agree to it. He leaves office at noon on March 4th. President Roosevelt's first action is to proclaim what he calls euphemistically a bank holiday, ordering all the banks closed across the country until this law is passed. Then, once the law is passed and in effect, he announces it to the nation via radio, saying that now the federal examiners will go to each bank and make sure they're being run properly. If it's a complete disaster, the bank will be closed, the depositors will be compensated. If there needs to be new management techniques, the federal government will explain what they are. And so most depositors, if they didn't withdraw all their money in a panic, ultimately do all right. But during that bank holiday, which lasts for almost a week, if you hadn't withdrawn money, you have no cash. And so the person who taught me modern U.S. political history as an undergraduate has a distinct memory. His birthday happened to fall during that bank holiday period. So it's the one birthday of his childhood where he received no present because there was no way to buy him anything. And his parents didn't know how to make much of anything. They lived in an urban apartment. So there was this trauma. I think for most people, the most of the painful memories associated with that the banking episode is if the bank failed in the late 20s or early 30s before the deposit insurance system was adopted, passed by into law and so on, because some of those people lost their entire life savings.
And this is when the Glass-Steagall Act was enacted.
Right. And part of that legislation,
which has since been undone, but
correct. And I can talk about that because it's a good
running out of time, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right. Well, that banking law, one of the things it did was prohibit ordinary bankers who secure mortgages for people who buy houses from investing in stocks and so on. And for a long time, that law was on the books. And in the mid-1990s, Congress decided, and the president, in a bipartisan way, decided to end that, to allow banks to go back into the business of investing in secured instruments, stocks, bonds, other things. And the theory at the time, Ann, was that conditions in the country have changed so much that we no longer need this New Deal era safeguard. And then within 5 years, we found out that things hadn't changed that much. And there's a lot of that thinking today. In other words, you meet a lot of highly educated people who say, well, you know, these lessons of the 30s have limited applicability in a world that's so different. Well, yes and no. It depends. The single biggest lesson of the Great Recession is that New Deal lesson was a sound one. We should have stuck with it. So, and we didn't. And the other part of it is once you create this problem of lots of mortgages that are in trouble, it's not easy to get back to where you were before with normal economic policies.
And, you know, just to cap it off, I mean, the idea that they reversed trend around 1938, but that's not what got us out of the mess. It was World War II ultimately.
Right. The steady forward motion of the economy was interrupted sharply. And if that happens, it's awfully hard to restart that process. And so the war comes along and it restarts the process, but not as an economic recovery measure, as a national military emergency measure. All this money must be spent to defend the country from foreign attack. It does have a consequence of
stimulating kinds.
But it means that the Depression lasts for 12 years with all sorts of long-term harmful consequences. And so the challenge here is to realize that some things are very different today, and we have the benefit of the lessons of the 30s. But you have to believe that the lessons of the 30s still apply in order to benefit from the lesson. Right?
Well, David Stubbin, thanks for sharing the lesson today.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
David Stubbin, professor of history and law at Ohio State University. He will be speaking tomorrow about the fiscal crisis of the 1930s and its consequences. If for more information, go to the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
What's your job on the movie?
Producer.
Associate producer. What was the last movie you produced?
High and Dry.
Who paid for that?
CFDC.
What's your middle name? What's your middle name? What's your middle name?
Leon?
Shoot him. He's an American spy.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ben Affleck. At the Golden Globe Sunday, his film Argo won for Best Film Drama, and he won for Best Director. Join us.
And Fresh Air is later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday with a discussion of social media in Columbus and also gadgetry with Geek.com blogger Russell Hawley. Join us for Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon. Mostly sunny skies today, a high of 35. There's a chance of some light rain snow mix tonight, a low of 29 degrees. Some clouds and sunshine on Wednesday, a high of 38. Support for 89.7 comes from Green Bean Delivery, offering home delivery of fresh organic produce and natural groceries, striving to make healthy eating more accessible to communities of Greater Columbus. Details on Green Bean Delivery's products, as well as how to place an order, can be found online at greenbeandelivery.com. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We've been looking back to the Great Depression to consider parallels between that and the Great Recession. There was a recession inside the Depression in 1937-38, caused, many say, by a tightening of fiscal and monetary policies in the United States. Joining us now to talk about the same issues now pending in Washington is Dispatch Washington correspondent Jessica Wehrman. Welcome back and Happy New Year, Jessica.
Hi, Happy New Year to you too, Ann.
So yesterday the president pretty much threw down the gauntlet at a news conference and said that he will not let Republicans tie an increase in the borrowing limit to cuts in future federal spending.
He did, and it's basically kind of the warm-up for what's going to be kind of a crazy couple of months here. February and March are going to be, I mean, if just when we had gotten over the New Year's fighting in Congress, we're going to have more coming up here.
No rest for the wicked, they say.
No, no. Mm-hmm.
So what's the feedback? I mean, what are the Republicans saying in response?
You know, it's interesting. I've got actually calls into a bunch of them, so I should be hearing back shortly within a couple of hours. But what I've actually heard is sort of an early indication that this might be different in so much as they might refuse to Well, let me back up a second. There are three things. There's kind of a triple threat going on. We thought that the fiscal cliff was bad, but now we've got actually three problems. And the three problems are this: we are running out of money. We've reached our debt ceiling, and so Congress at some point is going to have to increase the debt ceiling. We also have a continuing resolution that will be expiring at the end of March. And the continuing resolution is how Congress funds the government these days. It's just basically they pass this big bill full of funds, and that's running out. So they need to renew that. The third thing is the sequester. This fiscal cliff deal from last year, you'll remember, kicked the can down the road. We need a new phrase. I keep trying to think in my writer mind what's
but,
a new phrase.
But
for
when
that?
The shoe fits, no, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, I'm going. Okay, yeah.
Exactly. But basically at the end of February or beginning of March, this sequester goes into effect. And what that is, and I hate the word sequester too, for the record, is a series of $1.2 trillion in mandatory cuts over 10 years. So there's three potential fights. Up ahead. And the one that seems to be the biggest right now is a debt ceiling. Now, the Republicans are kind of indicating increasingly that they're willing to let one of two things happen. They're willing to say, you know what, we're not going to raise a debt ceiling. This is it. We're not.
But that means the United States goes into default.
Do you remember August 2011, there was this huge fight over the very same topic,
mm-hmm.
and there was a panic over it. If we don't raise a debt ceiling, they said over and over, it would wreck the economy. And, you know, that's not really been discussed as much yet, but, you know, we're pretty early in the fight. And by wrecking the economy, a couple of things could happen. You may remember in 2011, in July or August, Standard & Poor's downgraded us. And I read just this morning that Fitch, which is another credit rating firm, has also indicated that, you know, if they can't work this out, they might downgrade us. So there's that. There's the possibility of higher interest rates. There is economic uncertainty and an effect on the markets. So, you know, there's measurable impacts from not increasing the debt ceiling. The other thing that could happen is a government shutdown. A lot of the guys in Congress do not remember the last time the government shut down. They were not here. I mean, they remember it, but they didn't actually live through it. They weren't in Congress at the time. But you'll remember that things stopped working. Offices closed. So the stuff that we rely on from our federal government every day was not there for a time. And in retrospect, the history books kind of make it look like Congress really took the brunt of the blame for that shutdown. So that's the other risk.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question for my guest, Jessica Wehrman. She's a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch in their Washington Bureau. We're talking about the triple threat, debt ceiling, how Congress will fund government going forward, and the sequester. Give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. The debt ceiling, let's talk a little bit about that. If there is there's this debt ceiling. Now, for years, the debt ceiling has been around for a long time. We never even heard about it until 2011, many of us.
Because they would just kind of pass the increase to the debt ceiling, and they'd say, you know what, we've spent this money, and so we're going to raise it up a little bit more. But, you know, we had the new breed of really fiscally concerned lawmakers who said, you know what, we're not going to do this, and we have to cut spending, and this is, I'm going to use President Obama's term, a ransom that we're going to say, unless you cut spending, we are not going to give you more credit or more debt to have. So this is something that used to be, like much in Congress, you know, they would just kind of do it and call it a day. Mm-hmm. But now it's become not only a fight, but a huge fight, one of those fights that kind of make people sort of, you know, get a little twitchy.
And it does mean that if they don't raise the debt ceiling, that Congress can't spend the money that it owes for this and that.
Well, yeah, basically. So here's how it kind of works out. He runs out of money, or the federal government runs out of money, and you have to kind of figure out which bills to pay. I mean, it's like having a credit card bill and deciding which bills to pay with that credit card and which to delay. So what President Obama indicated yesterday was that he would still pay the debts. He would basically pay the interest and that sort of thing, but he would have to decide what other bills not to pay, such as, I mean, he indicated Social Security checks, veterans benefits, And his words, you know, we may not be able to pay our troops or honor our contracts with small business owners, food inspectors, air traffic controllers. These are things that we might not think about on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, when they're gone, we kind of miss them.
Well, do we really want to not pay our debts to other nations as well?
Well, he had indicated that would probably be one of the first things, you know, they would have to... There's a kind of a debate about this. You know, is it illegal for the president to refuse to pay for spending authorized by Congress? Is there a mandate to pay for debt before other obligations? So it's not really clear from the last time. It's not really clear how this plays out. It's not really clear what he has to pay. But he's kind of indicated that, you know, the debt comes first. And the stuff that we supposedly pay for on our own, like air traffic controllers, like veterans benefits, would have to be the things that would be delayed.
Kind of like bankruptcy.
You got to line up your bills. You know, which bills do you pay first? I mean, do you pay for the mortgage? Do you pay for the electricity? If you don't have a house, you don't have, you know, you don't need to pay for the power.
Just follow the bouncing ball. The president was asked yesterday whether he has a plan B if Congress doesn't extend the debt ceiling. Is that what it would be? Is just a course of cuts? And
I guess he figures out which bills to pay and which he doesn't. And, you know, that's kind of the debate. While there have been some threats from congressional Republicans to, you know, let the debt ceiling not expire, I don't think Speaker Boehner really wants that, because I think that there is clear economic implications from doing this.
And he also probably remembers the shutdown.
Yeah, he was here.
Yeah.
You know, the thing he's indicated, and actually it's interesting because, you know, this is sort of a riddle. What do he and Newt Gingrich have in common? Both have said that actually the leverage they have is the mandatory cuts, the sequester, because President Obama doesn't really want to do that either. You know, you're cutting $1.2 trillion across the board. Half would be military and defense spending. It would basically gut the Defense Department, and it would also gut discretionary programs. President Obama really doesn't want to see that go, does not want to see that go into effect either. So, you know, Boehner indicated in a Wall Street Journal article, I think it was last week or the week before, that that may be the leverage, because Congress could let that go through as well. I mean, this is another bargaining chip that hasn't really been discussed yet, but it could, you know, kind of rise to the fore as well.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call, talk with Jessica Werman, correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch in Washington. Jeff in Lexington, you're on the air. Welcome.
How are you doing this morning?
Fine, thanks.
There was a shutdown in the 90s.
That's what we were talking about, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I must have missed that fact, because of the simple fact that I went for training for OSHA down in Columbus. And the lady there that was giving the presentation, she simply said, well, here, let's call the government. And then when she called, she goes, oh, that's right, they're shut down. So, I mean, all my training went down the drain, you know, for the simple fact that the government had to have a day off or a week off or whatever they did. But to me, I mean, that was completely ridiculous.
It's hard to imagine all the different ways that people are affected when there's a government shutdown, right, Jessica?
There really are so many implications that we can't even think about. You know, going to the national parks, for example. You know, I mean, do you enjoy visiting the national parks for your vacation? Well, if the government's shut down, forget about it. You know, and I think the other thing is it's a really dangerous game to play to go into a government shutdown, because, people are already fairly convinced that Congress and the president, they can't get along. It's very dysfunctional. I mean, what greater proof than shutting down the federal government? So, there's so many risks with letting something like that happen that it's hard to imagine it happening, but it seems like it's increasingly possible. We just keep having fight after fight.
Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. We want to get to one more. Thanks a lot. Take care. David in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. It's just something that Jessica said about the Pentagon facing a $500 million budget cut. Without the benefit of the facts, I don't think that that would mean anything in the Pentagon because they have so much money and they have a lot of secret money. And lastly, their budget has increased, I think, 40% in 12 years.
Hmm. Unlike a lot of places in government. But okay.
Amen.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Jessica?
Well, there was an increase for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, which we could debate that. That's a whole other topic. Mm-hmm. But in recent years, it's actually been on the decline, and there have been budget cuts that have gone into effect. I guess when I think about these things, I think about sort of the bricks and mortar issue. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is near Dayton, is the only single site or the largest single site employer in the state of Ohio. And around Wright-Patterson, there are tons, and even in Columbus, there are tons of defense contractors who work with Wright-Patterson. So I guess when I think about these cuts, I think about what happens to Wright-Pat, to defense contractors, to people who, rely on the workforce at Wright-Patterson for their, restaurant or what have you. So, I mean, there are implications for this. And there was an economist who said this sequester, the impact of this sequester, again, I hate myself every time I use that word because it's so Washington-y.
There is no good word.
I know. I need to come up with a different phrase. But there was an economist who said that this would cause 2.1 million jobs to be lost over a period of time, because there's a lot of jobs that are, like it or not, affiliated with the federal government. There's federal research. There's research that occurs in Columbus that is funded,
right,
by the government.
And just the uncertainty, we did talk with contractors a month ago or so, and they said that they don't want to hire on right now because they just don't know. And
absolutely,
they still don't know.
Absolutely. And actually, one of the Republicans' greatest criticism of this deal was it didn't deal with the sequester. And now they're kind of getting used to the idea. And maybe they say it's the only way to get spending cuts out of the federal government is to let this go through.
Well, we'll talk about it again, I hope, Jessica. Thanks a lot for today.
Thank you.
Jessica Wehrman, she is a correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch in the Washington Bureau. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.